Welcome to Geared for Growth. I'm your host, Mike Mortlock from MCG Quantity Surveyors. Today, we're talking all things commercial property investing. It's a bit of a commercial 101 where we tackle some of those key misconceptions, perhaps, on things around: is commercial only about cash flow? Is it something that you need to be doing only when you already have a residential property portfolio? And are commercial properties that aren't worth $135 million inherently risky at that price point? And to walk us through all of that, we've got commercial property investing guru and commercial property author, Helen Tarrant from Unicorn Commercial Property. She walks us through those questions, gives us some really good insights from a high level in and around due diligence and how that differs from residential property. And she also gives us her tips for residential property investors wanting to pull the trigger on commercial and what they need to know to make sure they're not getting their fingers burnt. It's an awesome introductory interview with Helen, and I know you're going to get a tremendous amount out of it if you're considering commercial. Here's Helen. Tarrant, thanks for joining me on Geared for Growth.
Always nice to speak to you, Mike.
I think it's twice this week, but I'm very grateful to share any time I get with you and unpack a lot of the knowledge that you've got. For people that maybe haven't come across you before, Helen, what's your sweet spot in the property investing world?
So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Helen Tarrant. You can Google me. There's like 300, 500 videos out there of anything to do with commercial property. I would have to say we are the founders in the commercial property space when it comes to the education space of teaching investors going from not knowing anything about commercial into becoming full-fledged professional investors, all the way to like we're one of the first buyer's agents in the commercial space when buyer's agencies didn't even exist, and this was 2017, so a lot of people didn't know that. A lot of my work was done in referrals, and then we really started realizing that now there's a huge space between everyday Australians wanting to get into commercial property but not knowing the bridge of how to, right? And that doesn't mean that you have to go and buy $3 or $5 million, although a lot of our clients when they first start out will buy anywhere from, you know, $2 to $4 million. But sometimes you're starting out with a $500,000, $700,000 purchase, right? But you actually don't know, because when you go out there, one of the big things that we've realized is the stumbling block for investors has been that everything looks so good, but which one is actually the right one, right? That's the number one. The number two thing then becomes, how do I even know this return is actually good for this property, right? So how do you know you should buy in Brisbane versus Adelaide today, right? Yeah. Versus, or should you be staying, should you take a lesser yield and buy in Sydney, right? So all of those things make a difference, and all of these things goes in people's heads and they can't work it out, and then they end up walking away, it becomes too hard, right? Yeah. And then the regret is 3 or 5 years later, I should have bought that. If I'd only bought that, I would have more cash flow today, right?
Exactly.
So
exactly.
We really honed in our skill on helping everyday investors start out in commercial property investment and then growing their portfolio through different means, whether it's just super, through coming together joint ventures with a lot of their friends or colleagues, and also doing syndicated deals, as well as deciding sometimes they do developments or uplifts, right? And that's one of the areas we actually became really good at in the last couple of years, which is commercial property uplift, which probably is for another episode.
Probably. I think there's probably 18 episodes in just that introduction. But I want to pick up on one thing that you said. You know, you said you'll have sometimes first-time clients that'll buy a $3 or a $5 million property. Now, that's not accessible to the average everyday investor. And I wanted to ask you the question, is commercial the sort of thing that only people that have got a little bit of a residential portfolio should be looking at? Because there's always this kind of notion with investors, like, I want to get a few properties and then I want to do a development, or I want to get a few properties and then go to commercial. Do you think it's a necessity for people to have cut their teeth in resi first?
Look, a lot of our clients do, just because it's easier and it's something they understand. But recently, in probably the last 12 months or so, I've actually had a lot of young clients, probably when I say young, somewhere around mid 20s starting out their first purchase in commercial. And I just had a look around, made the decision that, look, they don't need to buy their forever home today. They also don't see that they can get the value or get into a particular market in the residential space. So they should just do, they should go and do commercial. And so they've come in and they're ready to learn, but mostly ready to implement. And the great thing about that is that when you're starting out, you are, you've got so much servicing in the commercial space. Like normally we see clients that come in and they go, look, we have 10 residential properties. We have, we're negative. We have no idea how to actually buy another property. We now have to switch to commercial. Whereas when you're in the space of someone coming in straight with nothing in the residential space, it's so much more opportunity because they can go and buy a property that has leases on month-to-month leases, which is not available to someone who can't service. And then they say, oh, well, that's fine. We'll renegotiate the lease with the tenant. We add value to this property. And we're not putting bathrooms or kitchens and knocking down walls. We're not doing any of those things. We're simply having a negotiation. We might be helping them install the air conditioning, do a few works they specify, and we've got a property that now has equity that allows us to go again in a very short space of time, right?
Yep.
And they have that benefit, added on benefit, then versus someone who already are leveraged.
Yeah. Yeah, so obviously it's better if their borrowing capacity isn't pre-committed, but is there a minimum income that someone really needs to be able to get started in commercial in a relatively safe way, would you say?
Zero.
Okay. I'll take that as a no. So the answer to that, I wouldn't mind you elaborating on because I know you're being cheeky and there's more to it, but there's some nuances in and around commercial that it doesn't really matter who you are or how much you earn, but you can actually finance deals based on the deal itself. So it is kind of the security for the loan. Is that right to say?
So let's have a look at it. So let's say that there's this let's say BHP is your tenant, right? Mm-hmm. And you have, you bought a warehouse with a BH, you want to buy a warehouse with a BHP as your tenant, except this property is in Kalgoorlie or a Mount Isa or somewhere that is just heavily mining town driven, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this might be a very secure property. The tenant might be on 3, 5, 10-year leases, and it might give you a sensational yield of 8 or 9 or 10%, right? You take that property to the bank, and the bank is going to look at that property and go, you still have to show me how you're going to service this property if tomorrow mining goes down and your tenant happens to break lease, right? Because we know that that property will then take 12 months, maybe even 18 months to fill because it is so specific to that tenant. It's so specific to the area, and the demand is going to go once mining goes. And we don't know that could happen tomorrow, that could happen never, right?
Yep.
So they're going to look at you to service. They're going to look at you for an income, right? And so you would have to be, I always say, look, if you want to buy that type of property, you would have to be either already have a portfolio of commercial property, or you have to be earning probably over $250,000 to be able to show the bank that if something did happen, you've got another way of being able to support the mortgage. Okay? Mm-hmm. But having said that, if, for example, you didn't buy the property with BHP and you came to Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane and you found a property that had, say, your normal average tenant that might be a financial planner, might be even just a cafe, not a brand name cafe, just a cafe owner, or you might have a little warehouse with just, you know, a mechanic in there, right? But it just happened to be in Sydney, Melbourne, or one of the metro cities. And the yield's not going to be crash hot. It's not 8 or 9%. It might be 5%. Right? And you go to the bank and says, look, I really want to finance this property. And the bank would go, that's no problem. We'll take this. We don't have to look at your income. You could be a bum sleeping on your mother's couch. We don't care. Because if the tenant went bust tomorrow, we could fill that within the next 2 to 4 weeks.
Yep.
Yeah. Just purely because there's such a demand of tenants. There's so many different multiple drivers in that economy. And we know that the rent's not going to go backwards. Like, they've done their research. The banks have done their research. Yeah. They know that that area is safe. So they go, well, we'll take the asset. That's fine. You show us you've got a deposit. We don't care whether you earn money or not. And therefore, you know, we'll finance that. Right? Yep. So it's very, very different. It's very deal dependent.
I'm guessing you have to sort of pay to play for those sorts of loans though, right? Where it might be the case, given, you know, interest rates are so high at the moment, are we at a point where that could be a negatively geared deal, or is it the case that the banks have done so much research that you don't actually really have to pay a premium on the interest rate?
So no premium on the interest rate. Interest rate's pretty much the same. You would actually pay more of a premium being in a mining town than or in a remote, smaller, let's say less than 20,000 people regional town than you would a metro. At 5%, right?
Yeah, okay.
I once had a deal in Tasmania, and you learn through every deal. I went and had a deal in Tasmania, and then I realized in Tasmania I'd actually find someone local in the area to do it. It has to be processed through the local banks over there. But a deal was assessed, and they added 1% charge on their interest rate because it happens to be on an island.
Right.
And I had to remind them that we all live on an island, actually.
Yeah. That's a point. Yeah. How did that conversation end?
Yeah, they were like, okay, good point.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I want to sort of dive into some of the commercial property sort of folk tales. They might be myths or they might be based in real fact. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is that when we're talking about commercial property deals that aren't $1, $2, $3 million, is there a degree of risk that might be considered unacceptable under that price point? Because I guess when you're buying something $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, $5 million, it's likely that it could be, you know, a real quality tenant, like a doctor's surgery that's been there for 30 years on a long lease, or it could be a real diversified sort of homemaker's center where there's quite a few different tenants and one, say, big landlord, big anchor tenant. Do you have to expose yourself to compromise and risk if you are looking for things sub $1 million?
Look, I think the thing is about value. Like for me, everything I look at when I find a property for a client, I look at value and I look at their ultimate future strategy, right? Mm-hmm. So if I was put in front of a property that, say, was 500K and it was a property in, let's say in Cairns or in Townsville or in Rocky or whatever, any of the regional areas out there, or a $500,000 property in Melbourne, but it happens to be an office space because at the moment no one likes office spaces, but the yields are relatively the same, I would choose the Melbourne office space. The reason I would choose that is because the back end growth of it. So if we're looking at the same returns relatively, the back end growth in Melbourne eventually on that office space will be stronger than in regional, but also the access of having more tenants and the likability of being able to raise rents, it's going to be better than the regional properties. Now, if my client was in the situation where they have a few residential and they're negative and they have to have some kind of positive cash flow, then they really have to go regional. But when they go regional, one of the big things is about value, right? And what we've seen in the last 3 years or so is that people have pushed out to regional. And it has caused basically a huge rise in the prices of properties in regional Queensland, especially. And what that means is that now at 500K, you're really buying someone's 300K property.
Right.
And so this becomes a thought process of, is it really worth 500K?
Yeah, right.
Right. And is it going to hold its value and become 650K or 700K in the next 3-5 years? And that's the question I ask myself. And I don't know if other investors ask themselves that, but I ask myself from doing, I would do a disservice to my client if I didn't, because my idea is that that property has to have that value in order for me to put a client into that deal. If it doesn't, then I'd be like, look, I just don't know if that will grow to that point. If you're happy with the cash flow, then you should take it. But if you want more than that, then we should look at something else. Right? And it's all about that question of where that value is.
Would you say that in that type of scenario where you're actually kind of thinking, gee, we could actually be overvalued in regions for this type of property. Do you feel like that's a risk that doesn't quite exist to the same extent with residential property? Certainly we have the cycles and the peaks and troughs, but it's just kind of like if you're patient enough and it's a diversified economy, it's probably going to move upwards at some point. But from a commercial point of view, because it's more about the leases there and you know the health of the local businesses that are the potential tenants of that property, that it is inherently a little riskier?
Let's put it this way. I'm probably the only person right now in this market, both residential and commercial, say don't buy in Perth. Right. I go out in my statements and I do it in my live events and I do it and I say, why would you buy in Perth right now? Right? The reason I disagree with people going to Perth is if you look at the growth in Perth that's happened in terms of its capital growth has been because the Eastern Seaboard has put all its money into Perth in the last 2 years.
That's true. If we look at our own data on that.
Yes. If you look at the natural growth, it actually hasn't had much natural growth. When we look at the last cycle of correction, the one thing that Perth is unique to every other state is that when they have a correction in their mining or any of their downturns, their property prices go back like 80%. Yep. So you're literally buying as you would bought 10 years ago. And this happened about 4 or 5 years ago in the market in Perth. Like you were buying the property as if, you know, and I know this because my husband was in oil and gas in Perth for 20 years. And when I met him, I traveled a lot to Perth and I have clients in Perth. And so I do know what's happened. Like we're literally looking at the price going, wow, we bought this like 20 years. Like you bought this 20 years ago, you could buy this again. And then 10 years later, you could buy it for the same price, right? So it's that same cycle. And I think that's one of the risks that people have in residential right now or have in the last 2 years that they're exposed to is that they've gone to regional areas because data has shown them it's gone good, right? But one of the things is that some of these areas, for example, Rockhampton, has been a 9% yielding commercial town, has been pretty flat for residential for the last two decades. Now, it's had a boom for about 3 or 4 years, which meant that people were buying into Rocky at 7%, sometimes even 6% yield, and they've had probably a 20%, maybe even more growth in residential. So for the average investor, it's fantastic. But for the known investor, the history is like that's got a risk that if the market and when the market, it's not if, it's when the market corrects itself, your 20% growth will be stagnant now for the next 5 or 7 years. You'll have negative equity in Rocky if you bought commercial at 6% because it's gone back up to 8%. Right?
Yeah.
So that's what the 2 years of blind investments a lot of investors have gone through without education or people who know the market have actually made that mistake. But that's not going to be seen until 2 years from now, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah, and it might seem good to buy an investment property and it go up 10 or 20% in the first 12 months, but you've got to sort of think, well, okay, if that's it for 5 or 6 years, does that actually outperform something that's doing a modest 6 or 7% year on year, especially when you factor in the compounding, right? So that is definitely a risk. I want to pick up on something you were talking about before, and that's the capital growth, because there is a pervasive notion that commercial is really all about the cash flow, and you can increase the capital value of it by renegotiating leases and perhaps doing uplifts, but there aren't a lot of market forces that are putting fire under the backside of commercial from a capital growth point of view. Would you argue against that point?
The Geared for Growth Property Investing podcast is presented by our business, MCG Quantity Surveyors. If you're an investor or a property professional looking to get the best tax depreciation deductions for yourself or your clients, please get in touch with us at mcgqs.com.au. It's our mission to help as many property investors as we can to maximise their claims and maximise their property education as well.
I would, absolutely. But the main problem with commercial property is lack of transparency. That's why people don't believe there's capital growth. You can see in residential, because we've got so much RP data, we've got a magical thing called Google who could tell you everything, right? But Google cannot tell you a lot of things about commercial property, and RP data can't tell you much about commercial property. And what they can't tell you is why the property was for sale 2 years ago for 500K and now listed for 1.5 million. Mm. It cannot tell you what the transition that's gone through, right? Mm. Whereas someone looking from my point of view, okay, sold for 500, it is where it is now. This is the tenant, this is the lease, this is the fit out they put into, this is why it's equate to, and this is the market changes which got to 1.5. Now, I know I'm not plugging my book, but if people do actually want a historical view of commercial property in terms of growth, there is a case study in my book which is called Catch Up with Commercial Property. And it details the 10 years I had of a property that I first bought. So I bought a restaurant premise in 2012 in Sydney for $360,000. It was yielding 8.6% net versus at that time, if I was to buy into a residential property, I would have bought a one bedroom and it would have yielded 5% gross. But in the 9 years, I sold in 2021. So 2012, I sold in 2021. The 9 years I've owned it, it's been consistent with rent. We've had some rental increases during those times. It's had COVID. And we actually sold it for $1,050,000 in 2021. Wow. Yeah, so there is capital growth. And if you look at historically in the last 3 years, we've had 40% capital growth in assets across the board. Doesn't matter if you're office or retail or warehouses in somewhere like the Gold Coast and the Sunshine Coast, all across there. We've actually had less growth in commercial property, probably in Sydney and in Melbourne versus what we've had in those fringe regional areas or fringe city areas. We've even had somewhere around 20 to 30% in areas of Townsville, right? Which is crazy, right, in commercial property. Mm.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I suppose in that case study, that might seem like a good deal for a residential property, which at that point in time was probably negatively geared, or at least, you know, is break even at best. But that commercial property is also paying for itself and then some over the life of the time that you owned it as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Back in 2012, the interest rate was about 6% when we got in, except the difference is that at that time in Sydney, the yields were 2% higher, so it was much, much better. The thing about capital growth in commercial property is that so few people in the market actually understands it. And very much the superficial, there's a lot of people who are buyers agents who came from the residential space, and they don't understand commercial property capital growth. So they're basically saying, well, you get cash flow, that's all you get, that's where it is, right? But when you delve deep into it, when we look at the Harvey Norman, people who created Harvey Normans of this world, you know, the Trigger Boffs of this world who created Westfield, they didn't, and when you look at the property funds and everything else, they're not playing the cash flow game. They're playing the capital growth valuation game. Every time it gets revalued, it's like we get this huge number, right? It's like, oh, wow, our portfolio just went up by another billion or 500 billion or something like that, right? And what they're tweaking is and there's a few levers that they're pulling. And one of the levers is the tenant. One of the levers is the rent. But they're also playing the market as well, right?
Yeah.
So, and then watching markets. But commercial property doesn't have the property clock because it's based on a tenant having a 3 or 5 year lease. So you'll find that a lot of times in a market, when tenants tend to all come off 3 or 5 year leases, that within probably a 6 to 9 month period, all the value jumps in that area because tenants are shifting around. There's revaluation of assets, a revaluation of rents, and everything kind of happens. And then people go, "What just happened? That property, that area was nothing, and then now it's like bang." And then all the investors go in because they think, "Oh my god, I've missed the market, and it's had another surge."
So that's where I think those nuances, people outside of the industry can get themselves into trouble because they don't understand how it works. And I think if I can focus the next question on some of the areas where people perhaps can go wrong, I think that's in the due diligence, right? Because if you think about residential due diligence, it might be things like, is it in a floodplain? Are there any caveats, you know, easements, all those sorts of things, pest and building. But with commercial, there's a lot more kind of legal things in the mix there. What are some of the key things that you think are different that a residential investor should really understand? Otherwise, they get their fingers burnt.
So due diligence is, most people think, so what they do is most people think they get their solicitors to do their due diligence in commercial property. That is probably one of the worst mistakes you can make. And I'm not, this is not a bash against solicitors. It's solicitors read leases and they give you a comment on leases, right? They are not trained to look at the nuances of how that lease applies in real life, right? Yep. They look at the tenant ledger and says, the tenant has paid rent, right? But what we look at is, has the tenant paid rent every single month on the same day? Or have they gone down in slippery slope and said, they pay rent on the 1st and they pay rent on the 10th and they paid rent on the 5th, right? We look at the bond and say, well, is the bond like equitable to the length of the lease? Right? We look at things like, what are the obligations of the tenant under the lease and is it actually happening in real life? So are they cleaning their grease traps? Right? Are they getting the air conditioning serviced? Do they have additional insurance for public, liability and things like that? So, for example, a gym. Are they paying premium if they're a tattoo parlor? Like, have that been covered? Right. Someone who has a deep fryer, has that been noted? Right. Has that been cleaned, treated properly, so that we're not having a fire hazard? Is there fire separation? Like, there's a whole heap of things, because commercial property, unlike residential, is a live deal until the day you settle on it. And that's running with your tenants, right? So we've had some funny situations, in obligations. So one of our clients have Orica as a tenant. And they're a big technology company. So they have it very specifically in their lease that their aircon can't be down for more than 48 hours, right? That's a very onerous obligation. Because they've got, if their aircon goes in, you're expected to have someone on site within 24 hours. It needs to be back up in 48 hours. Otherwise, it goes into where they don't have to pay your rent, because that's their most the issues that they, you know, that they need to cover up, right? So you've got those kind of issues that are put into the rent that you have to know as the incoming purchaser that that's your obligation. And in real life, that's a much heavier obligation than having a gym. If one air conditioning is down, it's okay. People get a bit more sweaty. It becomes Bikram yoga instead, right?
That's a great example, that one.
Yeah. I mean, we've had also situations like when you have a bank, sometimes, and this was in different areas, banks might have those electronic doors. And it's very obscure. You have to maintain the electronic doors. So you have seen obscure things that's buried in the lease. That what does that mean in practice, right? So we have recently we've had things about like when you have a large industrial property, like people want to buy industrial, but when industrial property goes to a certain height, it all sometimes you need to have a sprinkler system, right? So you have a sprinkler system, and in the lease it says, oh, you know, there's sort of, it doesn't even mention about that. Just says, oh, you know, the tenant needs to have the safety and all of the stuff. But in practice, they need to have a sprinkler system. But where is that water housed?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not a question you sort of automatically think at the incoming purchaser, where is the water from the sprinkler house? We just recently did a $5 million purchase for a client who is very in great logistics. Right? So they've got sprinkler systems. They've got 11-meter tall warehouse, right? And we had to go and check, well, where's the tank or where the sprinklers are? Is that on title to them? When was that tank service last? And how much is the responsibility to maintain that tank? There's the tenant versus them, right? And that's an obscure thing. Like, no one would actually think about it, but it's very specific to that deal, right?
And there's all sorts of requirements for different businesses and industries like that, where they do have to have a certain infrastructure in place and then they have to prove that it's maintained and things like that, whereas residential's not quite the same. Helen, this has been a whirlwind interview, and I think we need to come back. But if you can tie a nice little neat bow around, you know, commercial investing for residential focused people that have come from a residential background and are curious about it, if you had to pick the top three things that you would really want that person to know so that they can transact on a deal safely, assuming they don't use an expert like yourself, what would those three things be?
So the number one thing is to acknowledge and realize that residential is different from commercial. Firstly, to understand the commercial plays its own game and its own beast and all organism, right? You need to learn the rules of the game, the rules of engagement you play, right? That's the number one thing. But you must invest in commercial property with a strategy. The answer to that is when you buy residential, because you're up against market forces of market growth and everything else, you can predict to the best of your predictability of where that's going to grow, where that's going to go. So, and if your friends and everyone else buys in the same area, if you buy in the same area, look, you're going to do okay. You're going to do okay, right?
Yep.
But in commercial, that doesn't work. Just because your friend bought a warehouse doesn't mean you need to buy a warehouse. Your friend bought an office, you need to buy an office, right? The strategy of what you want to do or achieve needs to be formalized before you make that first investment. Commercial property is a very, you can control a lot more things than you do in residential. So, for example, you want the type of returns you want, you can go to those areas. You want the cash flow, you want the growth, you can go to those specific areas and design a portfolio. So it's worthwhile for you to go and work out your strategy first. And when I say about strategy, I'm saying, all right, I want to replace $50,000 in passive income. I want to replace $100,000 in passive income, right? And then work backwards, which is quite interesting because recently I've been given a mandate by one of our investors who said to me, I want $20 million in equity. I want to make $1 million in passive income, and I want to do it in 3.5 years. I don't know how to, but I know I can do it in commercial property. You need to tell me what that pathway needs to look like, and I will provide you the ingredients of that, which is money, obviously.
I was going to say, I hope they're not that bum on their mum's couch you were talking about.
And I was like, okay. So he goes, find me the solution. So I've been workshopping how I can get him there. And I sort of gave him a plan to say, look, I can get there in 5 years. And he's like, no, I need to get my 3.5. So we need to step up, like, the injection of cash or whatever it is that we need to do for this property. So that's a very complex design blueprint, right? Mm-hmm. That's something that you give to a physicist who goes, okay, this is my model and this is what I have to pull together the growth, the cash flow, the manufactured uplift, the areas around different parts of Australia to be able to achieve that for you, right? But that's what I talk about, what makes us different here in unicorn commercial property and what Helen Tarrant does. Is the designing of that portfolio. It's so important because our clients get their results because they know from day one, if they buy this property, they will achieve their results in 2, 3, 5 years. I always remember the one thing the one client said to me when she bought her first commercial property. She said, I love the property on the Gold Coast that I walked into because it had marble floors and the lift was great. It was an A-class fit out. I just fell in love with it. But I know, logically, I needed to invest in the regional property you found me for cash flow because I've got my negative residential in my strategy, right? And I don't like that property, the regional, but I'm going to buy it even though I love this property in the on the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
Because she knows
it's not about loving it, right?
Yeah, it's not about loving it because I know that's going to deliver me the result, right? And so that's what it comes back to, having strategy. It's really important for the client because you've got to know if with certainty 1, 2, 3 is going to be able to be achieved, right?
Yep.
And then finally, I'm going to say this is a mistake that most investors make when they get into commercial, is that they look for the unicorn and they spend 2 years looking for the unicorn and someone else has built the unicorn portfolio. So that's why I call my company Unicorn, because everyone turns up and go, I want the 10% yielding property in Sydney under $1 million with development potential and a national tenant on a 10-year lease.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're selling that one, you've got my number.
So I said, look, but they literally spend years looking for it. And I said, well, rather than doing that, why don't you get a property that does cash flow, a property that does growth, and then a property that does uplift? Then each property produces to the maximum what they're meant to do, and you actually have a better portfolio that goes faster.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So understand the rules, have a strategy, and forget about the unicorn, because you might find it one day, but you don't want to wait 10 years to pull the trigger and miss the gains that you can get. I think those are some pretty awesome tips that anyone would do well to follow. Helen, thank you very much for sharing your wisdom on this one, and we'd love to have you back.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Thanks.
Cheers.